Right, this is talk seven now that we're doing on day two on the series of how to identify and handle wicked people. Let me just make one quick point that relates back to the end of the previous talk I was doing when I spoke about Matthew 7:1, when Jesus says, "Judge not that you be not judged. Cretase not that you be not cretased." And we were looking at how elsewhere in the Bible we're commanded to judge, in another sense, diakrino. Well, if you look, even in the very Sermon on the Mount itself, even just five verses later in what Jesus is saying in Matthew 7, this is what he says in verse 6. He says, "Do not give dogs what is holy, and do not throw your pearls before pigs." Okay? Now think about it. You've just been commanded not to judge in the sense of cretes. Now he's asking you not to give dogs what is holy and not to throw pearls before pigs. So, in that very same talk, Jesus is saying something which requires you to diakrino. It requires you to decide who the dogs and pigs are. Jesus isn't talking about literal pigs and dogs. Who goes around throwing pearls in front of pigs? No one's doing that literally. He's talking about identifying who in life are the dogs and the pigs in your life, and you've got to identify them in order not to give them what's holy or throw pearls in front of them. So in the very same talk, Jesus himself is implicitly requiring you to make that assessment or evaluation of people in order to come to that conclusion. And there are many other conclusions you need to come to likewise, but just I emphasize that. Don't fall for the trick that you're not allowed to form any kind of assessment, evaluation or judgment of anybody. You are in the right sense, you're not allowed to in the wrong sense. Okay, let me carry on then. Let's look at a question which probably not many people have ever thought about, and that is, what burden of proof applies when you're deciding something? And how certain do you have to be? How confident do you have to be of the facts, of the rightness or wrongness of someone's case in order to find for them or find against them? And this is a problem that judges have to face all the time, isn't it? How much evidence is needed. Now, what burden of proof, as it's called, is needed when we are forming a judgment about the wickedness or otherwise of the people we know? And this is important because sincere people place a high value on justice and fairness. And as a result, sincere, simple, naive people often misunderstand what is required in order to conclude that something has been proved. And I think they have muddled ideas from watching films on the telly about criminal courts in which things have to be proved beyond all reasonable doubt. Now, that's what criminal courts have to do, but you're not a criminal court. And God does not want you to act as if you were one. And therefore, that is not the test which you have to use, because a criminal court operates to an impossibly high burden of proof from your perspective. Now, And it has its reasons why it does that. But if you operated like a criminal court and only labelled a person as wicked if you had proved it beyond all reasonable doubt, that means, by the way, that even the slightest scintilla of doubt that might be left, a 1% doubt as to whether that man actually robbed that bank, the jury must acquit him. Because they've just got that little tiny, tiny doubt. So they must acquit him. So in our criminal system, when someone's acquitted, it doesn't mean they're innocent. Notice, we don't call them innocent, we call them not guilty. Because we haven't established that they're guilty. It doesn't mean they're innocent. The vast majority of the people who are acquitted in our criminal courts are all guilty. It's just that they couldn't prove it to the standard required of a criminal court. Now, leave aside the rights and wrongs of that. The point is, that system, that standard, that burden of proof is not applicable to you. And admittedly, if you used it, if you used that and only labelled a person as wicked if you'd proved it to that level, it is true that you'd never falsely label anyone as wicked who wasn't wicked. That is true. But it would come at a high price. Because it would mean that you were falsely labelling multitudes of people as being innocent when they're not innocent. Do you see? And so that avoidance of that injustice would come at the cost of an enormous injustice on the other side of the equation. So what should you do then? I would suggest that you use a similar test to the one that's used in a civil court or tribunal. And that's called the balance of probabilities test. And what do we mean by that? You see, if in a civil court, the judge there, if he comes to the view that the case, that A's case is just 50.1% convincing and B's case is 49.9% convincing, A receives 100% victory, 100% judgment in A's favour. Do you see? It's like a coin that has to come down heads or tails, completely heads or completely tails. So if two people are arguing and the judge in a civil court thinks, I'm slightly, very, very slightly more persuaded by A than I am by B, A wins completely, B is defeated completely. Do you see? That's totally different from what prevails in a criminal court where you have this beyond all reasonable doubt test, where even the slightest doubt about A's guilt requires him to be acquitted. Okay. I think that's a much more appropriate way to think about it. Am I persuaded on the balance of probabilities that this is correct or not? So, but you see, even there, that can sometimes be too high a test. Even the balance of probabilities, because, you know, if you have even got basis for a doubt or suspicion about a person, you need to greatly increase the level of your vigilance. When all you have at the moment is a suspicion or a concern or a doubt, you haven't even reached the stage of being 50.1% convinced of their guilt. I mean, if you had a doubt about whether a glass of water has cyanide in it, would you say, I'm drinking that until I'm persuaded 50.1% likely that the cyanide is there? Until if I'm only 49% likely, I'm drinking it because I don't want to criticize that glass of water, you know, wrongly. Do you see? If you were in doubt about something like that, you would play safe, wouldn't you? And equally, we need to play safe sometimes with people. We take extra precautions. We trust them less. We make extra provisions to protect ourselves and protect our church and protect people, even where we have a concern or an unproven doubt. Okay. So bear that in mind. Another point to make, I'll come back to this burden of proof thing later, but another point to make is that both good and evil can come from the same person. And indeed, that combination is fully to be expected. So don't be thrown by it. You must never assume that just because you see a person doing something good or saying something true, that no evil could ever come out of them. It can, and it does. And likewise, if we ever see or hear a person operating, even validly, in spiritual gifts, it doesn't mean that that person could never operate invalidly or inaccurately or even falsely. It doesn't follow. So even if they're operating in genuine gifts of the Holy Spirit, it doesn't mean that they could never mistakenly do so in their own flesh or do so even dishonestly or even under the influence of a demon. It doesn't follow. And people can and frequently do operate in all sorts of inconsistent ways. And you have to take account of that when assessing others. So never assume that a person could never do any evil or be wicked merely because you've seen them do something good recently or even in the past, because that simply doesn't follow. And it's a sweeping assumption that you must not make, because you're effectively turning off your carbon monoxide detector because on a certain day in the past there was no carbon monoxide. Do you see the point? The fact that there was no carbon monoxide yesterday does not mean that you turn off your carbon monoxide detector today. You just leave it on, even if there was no carbon monoxide yesterday. So your discernment must be in operation all the time. You don't switch it off, even with the people who you've seen no wrong in. You still keep your carbon monoxide detector on. And also, you do so for this reason, if nothing else, because you have to measure fruit over a period of time. The fruit of people's lives is not assessed by a mere glance or just a photograph on a certain day. What was their fruit this afternoon? You know, no, it's what has been their fruit over a period of time. That tells you whether the person is real. Is it consistent? Do they keep it up? And returning to our little point about Ted Cruz and Donald Trump, what's the fruit of Ted Cruz and what's the fruit of Donald Trump? If I was measuring their fruit, leave aside a host of other things you could say about both. I mean, Cruz is just superb to me. I think he's the best candidate to stand since Abraham Lincoln. But the point is, Trump, just appalling in virtually every way. Possibly he's kind to his dog, he may be, but I can't think of anything else good to say about the man. But leave that to one side. Cruz, a lifelong conservative and constitutionalist with a devotion to upholding the Constitution. Now, given that the President and every member of the Supreme Court and every senator has to swear to uphold the Constitution, wouldn't it be good to check out whether they've been upholding the Constitution so far in life? Wouldn't that be like an obvious place to start? So if you're measuring their fruit, wouldn't you want to look at the degree to which they have upheld the Constitution? Well, Ted Cruz has spent decades fighting for it. Donald Trump doesn't even know how to spell it. He knows nothing about the Constitution. He's had no interest in it in his entire adult life. He's never even read the Constitution. Ted Cruz memorized it when he was 13. The thing is that Donald Trump knows nothing about it. And he has been a conservative for about a few months. Before that, he was a Democrat. Now, leave aside whether being a Democrat or a Republican is a good or a bad thing. The point is, if you're measuring fruit, you want to look at consistency. And so Donald Trump isn't showing any consistency whatsoever. Within the space of a day, he can express 5 different opinions on the same point. Now, the point about that is this. If a man is like that, you don't trust a man like that. You want to see consistency of output, consistency of stance, consistency of integrity, not just integrity for a single afternoon. You want to be looking over a period of time, not necessarily decades, but you want to see months and preferably years of consistent integrity in order to say that man has integrity. These things can't be decided in a single minute. And one final point on this, in identifying the wicked, the mere fact that someone has been a victim of the wicked at some point in the past does not in any way imply that they themselves must therefore be a good or innocent person. I've made this mistake a number of times. I've thought that this fellow has been a victim, therefore the wicked must have picked on him because he's a sincere, innocent, good person. That doesn't follow. Equally, to say, I've thought this, that the enemy of my enemy is my friend. That doesn't follow. So the enemy of your enemy is not your friend. There's no reason to think he's your friend. He's just the enemy of your enemy. And I've seen many, many times the wicked picking on each other, attacking each other. Look what goes on in Islam. Muslims are attacking each other the whole time. But the Muslims who are being attacked by other Muslims are just as misguided, false in their theology, and often wicked in their attitude and approach. They're just as much in even jihadists as the other jihadists who are attacking them. Do you see? Now, that's on a grand scale, but even in a small scale, even in your law firm, in your factory, in your office, in your hospital where you work, in your school, the fact that one member of staff victimizes another does not mean that the one being victimized is therefore a good, faithful, honest person who's a friend of yours. It doesn't mean anything. It just means they've been victimized. And the wicked will victimize each other. And the victim of a wicked person can be just as wicked as the one who victimized him. And he might not be. All I'm saying is it doesn't follow to make that sweeping assumption. They can be just as wicked as their persecutor and no more loyal or faithful than he was. So that's not a basis for you to conclude that he must therefore be someone you can cleave to, rely upon, trust in, etc. It doesn't follow. All right, another point. Don't judge people by their natural talents or spiritual gifts. Do so overwhelmingly on the basis of their character. So you really don't want to be judging anyone on the basis of their gifts, because it's not a basis. It doesn't, you're trying to measure temperature in decibels. It doesn't compute. You don't measure trustworthiness through giftedness. It's simply got nothing to do with it. Whether it's spiritual gifts or natural talents, they have nothing at all to do with whether the person can be trusted. So you could have someone who has tremendous natural gifts, but they're totally untrustworthy. And they can have tremendous spiritual gifts, totally untrustworthy, a false teacher, etc. So the fact that someone has gifts, even spiritual gifts, does not mean that God approves of them, validates them, considers them to be trustworthy, that you can then trust them. It doesn't mean that. You need to be much more broadly based in your assessment and evaluation before you label someone as trustworthy. And so, in fact, the more gifted a person is, the more discerning you need to be, because the more damage they can do if they're not trustworthy. You know, how much damage can a secretary do? How much damage can a managing director do? How much damage can a prime minister do? So the more senior and gifted someone is, the more rigorous you need to be in your assessment of their trustworthiness. And that is to state the position broadly. But I've come across many people who've had gifts of one kind and another and been grievously false. And in book six, I tell the story of a man that I'm giving him the name Carlos. And he came from South America many years ago to the UK. And he came to do a week-long series of meetings with our church and the churches in our town and area. And it was at a time when a lot of strange things were happening spiritually. People were falling over and being knocked over in meetings, falling on the ground, going unconscious. And at the time, my IQ was very low. And I was naive enough to see this as being remarkable. You know, and what I did, I took a week off work and volunteered to be the driver for Carlos throughout his stay. I also, because I became his chauffeur, basically, but I also had him stay as a guest at my house. And I think God arranged that. God arranged it to happen that way, because he wanted me to see the way Carlos acted and lived right up close for a whole week. Very, very close. To see him, his real character, how he behaved behind the scenes when nobody was watching. God wanted me to learn about my own naivety and also how false people can be even when they are big names in the church. And I'm talking about in the church. Underline these words, in the church. Not talking about in the world. Now, I can tell you for certain, it was very clear that Carlos had remarkable spiritual powers. I saw him many, many times at close range, only 2 feet away, and I saw the things he did. And he was praying over people, blowing on them, gently touching them with his fingertips, and they would be knocked sideways, fall to the ground. They went over as if a rugby player had run into them. And I think, demonically speaking, that was pretty much what happened. Some demonic rugby player just ran into them when he prayed for them and knocked them flying. They went sideways with intense force. And it was physically impossible for Carlos to have faked this or for them to have faked it. You know, in the films when they shoot people and they just go bursting sideways, the way they achieve that, they have like cables attached to the back of the person. And when the fake gun is fired, someone behind pulls the cable so that the actor is pulled backwards without him having to do anything. And that's how they manufacture that impression of being blasted backwards. Because you can't engineer it just for yourself. If you try and hurl yourself backwards, it looks obvious that that's what you're doing. These people were not doing that. They were being knocked sideways by something other than themselves, with an intensity and a speed that was physically impossible to manufacture. So I saw it. At the time, I thought this was the Holy Spirit doing this. Later, I came to believe that it was demons doing it, and everything I've seen and heard since makes me more certain of that. So I was with Carlos the whole week, and seeing all this. God wanted me to see it, and in order to form a view of it. And as the week progressed, I began, gradually, my eyes began to open and to see things. And there was one particular day, some point in the week, we went to a particular church in a nearby city, not in our own town, and a bunch of church leaders were there from that city. And Carlos had been invited to come and meet this bunch of church leaders. And the thing was, they were openly skeptical about him, and they showed it in some of their comments, in their tone and their comments when they first met him. They weren't convinced about him at all. But anyway, in this meeting, he prayed over these leaders, and I was there in the meeting. And even though he was several feet away from them, every one of those leaders was suddenly knocked over at great speed and put unconscious on the ground. They were there rolling about, moaning on the ground, semi-conscious or even unconscious. I saw it all with my own eyes. And these were people who didn't believe in Carlos. Some of them didn't. Now, what made me concerned was, afterwards, when we drove back, Carlos was laughing about it in the car in a surprisingly disrespectful way about these leaders. He made fun of the fact that they doubted him, and that had irritated him. We shouldn't be irritated that people doubt us. It's their freedom to doubt us if they want to doubt us. There's no obligation on them to have any confidence in you or me. That's their free choice. But he was arrogant about it, and he believed that God had taught them a lesson. And he said so openly, and I felt arrogantly. Now, that jarred with me at the time. Because you see, what I mean by jarred is, you get confused and bewildered because you're holding a number of inconsistent thoughts all at the same time, and it creates a kind of incongruity, you might say, or a kind of inconsistency where you're holding two or three thoughts that aren't consistent with each other, and that creates confusion and bewilderment. Because on the one hand, I had formed the view that Carlos was genuine, he was from the Holy Spirit was giving him this power. On the other hand, I was thinking, but in his character, in his behavior, he really behaves badly, and I'll come on to other things he did. But what I did, the mistake I made, I kept putting my unease to one side and not allowing myself to believe that he was a deceiver. You restrain yourself from allowing yourself to form a conclusion that you don't want to form. And that creates, I think, in you a kind of bewilderment, because you're not perhaps conscious that you're doing this, but you're holding two or three conflicting thoughts all at the same time. And that's bewildering. Some of you will have felt that, perhaps without putting into words exactly what it is that's happening. That's what was happening with me. It was jarring with me, but my mistake was that I suppressed the unease. And I relied overmuch on the opinions of others. Others who were older than me in the church believed in Carlos. They validated him. They thought he was genuine. And unwisely, I allowed myself to be influenced too much by them, and I didn't question it adequately. But later, my eyes began to open more and more, and I began to wonder about him more openly and consciously. And I began to see that increasingly and repeatedly, he was behaving in a carnal, sensual, proud, and even dishonest way. And let me just give one example of that. There was one particular day. Two or three times Carlos had prayed over me. You know, this praying and seeing people fall like nine pins. And he would get like a strike. All nine pins would go down except me. And it was like at the bowling alley where there's one pin standing. Well, I was the one pin that never went down. And this irritated him. And two or three times he did it, and all these people went flying. Genuinely, they weren't faking it. I'm convinced they weren't. But I stood there unaffected. And on about the third time this happened, I saw in Carlos's face irritation and frustration that I was just standing there. Now, I wasn't willing to deceive anyone, fake anything, pretend anything. I'm simply not willing to do anything that isn't genuine. And there I was standing up. And in a certain sense, I looked a little silly because all these people were being prayed for and down they went. Now, this was deemed by them and the audience to be a mark of God's approval. Well, I was the only person there, on the face of it, ostensibly, who lacked God's approval. But I wasn't willing to pretend to have God's approval if I didn't have it. I wasn't willing to pretend anything whatsoever. And I'm still not. The thing was, there I stood like a duck egg on the stage, like a lemon. And you feel a little silly in a certain sense, or conspicuous, you could say. And but I wasn't willing to fake anything. But what Carlos did this particular time, about the third time that I didn't fall over, he came up to me and he pushed me over. And he got his hand and he had his back to the audience and he pushed me with some force and I fell backwards. Okay, but I knew perfectly well he'd just done it. Nobody else knew that because he got himself between his hand and the audience and pushed me over. They didn't see. They'd just seen all these others properly knocked sideways by demonic rugby players and then I went down. To them it all must have looked the same. Except that I immediately got back up. So it's like there used to be an advert in the UK. Weebles wobble, but they don't fall down. Remember that? Well, I was a weeble. And so when you knocked me down, I just got straight back up. And I made sure of it. I was not having it. I wasn't having anyone pretend anything or deceive anyone through me. So up I got, like a weeble, straight back up. And Carlos was angry. You could see it. And I was getting in the way of his act. I was refusing to cooperate. He'd hoped I'd play along. Possibly there were some others who weren't genuinely knocked over. Possibly some of them played along. I don't know. It may well have been the case. Some at the edges. I know I saw the real ones go down. But it's quite possible because this was happening in big, big rooms. And I wasn't close to everybody. I'm just talking about the ones I was standing 2 or 3 feet from. There were some people who were going down who were 30, 40 feet away. I don't know what happened to them or whether they were genuine, but I know that what happened to me was not genuine. So I refused to be a party to that. And as I look back, I think my sincerity of character protected me. Now you see how your character is either your protection or your undoing. You know how we speak of the breastplate of righteousness? Now in part that's imputed righteousness given to us at justification. That is something we need to have. The breastplate of righteousness, in part also, is the integrity of your character. And if you have total honesty, integrity, and behave genuinely all the time, that is a protection, an Ephesians 6 type protection for you. And I believe, I don't know about any of the others, I can't comment, but I know that I was sincere. And God knew it. And he wouldn't let anything, no demonic rugby player was allowed to tackle me. So all these demonic rugby players, well, they just had to stand back. I think there was an angelic England rugby player standing right in front of me, not letting anyone tackle me. And so that's the way it was. But I think if I had been willing to pretend, if I'd been willing to play along, if I had been willing to say, everybody might think I'm an inferior Christian because I'm not falling over. I'm going to fall over and try and be good like the others. I would have forfeited, I think, God's protection. And God's protection would have gone away. And I would have become demonically influenced, like I think many of those people were. And some of the people who were doing that then, I've looked at their lives since. And I think they've, insofar as I can gauge anything, they've gone further and further into error. And further away from a biblical position. And the people who were doing that at the time. Anyway, be that as it may, I jumped straight back up and Carlos was angry. It was a blow to his ego. I could see it in his face. He didn't like it at all. But it started me thinking much more carefully about him. I should have been thinking earlier, but it took until that stage in the week before I began to think much more carefully about him. But other things were also revealed. And I'm telling you all this because I want you to get it. This is a man in the church who's a leader of leaders. He's come over because the leaders think he's wonderful. And he's a leader of leaders and he's a big name in the church. And I want you to know what his character was like. So other things. He was very rude and ungrateful in the way he treated people. Now, no leader has the right to be rude and ungrateful. Doesn't matter who you are. Doesn't matter how much God uses you. In fact, on the contrary, the more God uses you, the bigger you are, the more respect you need to show to everybody, the more you need to treat everybody the same, whether they're a janitor or a secretary or a prime minister or whatever. A road sweeper is all the same to God, and he wants you to think that way. Nobody's better or worse in God's eyes in that sense. Of course, they're better and worse in terms of their skills. They're better and worse in terms of their character. But they're not better or worse in terms of their value in God's eyes. And that's vital to get that. Now, Carlos didn't get that. Carlos judged people according to their usefulness to him, not their inherent value. And that is something you must not do. People are not valuable if they're useful to you, and not valuable if they're not useful to you. That's how he saw it, though. And I remember being appalled. There was a man called Peter that he was a church leader down in the south of England, of a small church, and we had a much bigger church at that time. And Carlos, up until this point, had been driven around by Peter, who was doing my chauffeur job. And when Carlos came up where we were, I drove him around. And Peter had been helping and sort of sorting out things for Carlos until this point. But in the time that Carlos was with us, he came to national attention. A TV crew came to do a program about him. We had like an open-air meeting in a park. TV cameras came and filmed things happening. And Carlos was coming to national attention. And when this happened, I heard him, and he proposed to dispense with Peter and work instead with the leaders from our town. He wanted to work with us instead. Now, this was thrilling and exciting to the other leaders in our town. But when I heard him say this, I was appalled and I felt sorry for Peter. And I thought, well, Peter's been driving you around. I identified with him as a fellow chauffeur. And I thought, he's been doing this job until now. Why are you ditching him? Because you've got new friends. Why are you ditching this man who's been faithful to you? But he was throwing away like a toy when he got a better toy, and dumping the old toy. And I thought, this is not right. So this is the sense of ambivalence I had, that I was struggling with. Why is this man being used by the Holy Spirit when his character is so deficient in various ways? But an even bigger issue was the way Carlos spoke about his wife. I didn't like the way he spoke. He was very disrespectful about her. You should never do that. Never make jokes about your wife. Never disrespect her. Never speak down about her. Never. Always be honouring. But he was dishonouring. And I didn't like that. He would just sort of say cutting, barbed things. She wasn't there. She was back in South America. But just the way he spoke about her, you could tell it wasn't good. But I also heard and saw the way he was with other women. Things he said about women. Things I heard about him as well. But also some things I saw and heard. He was carnal. He was sensual. And I didn't like it. So there it was. It confused me. There he was with great spiritual power, but very deficient in his character. But what I found most surprising was he had no shame. There was no shame on his part about anything he was doing wrong. He wasn't bothered about anything that he was doing wrong. And he seemed to me not to be the slightest bit concerned about the day of judgment. Now I am. Every day I think about the day of judgment. I can't do things because they would be brought up at the day of judgment. There are things I must not do. Steps I cannot take. Corners I cannot cut. People I cannot use. Because if I did, Jesus would raise it with me at the day of judgment. I don't actually want to do any of those things, but even if I wanted to, I must not and may not, because it will be raised with me at the day of judgment. And I don't want it to be. But he had no concern about any of this. He wasn't ashamed at all of anything he was doing. Now that puzzled me at the time. It no longer puzzles me. Because if a person is wicked, they don't have any shame. And the thing is this, one of the identifying features of the wicked is the absence of shame. They have no embarrassment. They parade their sin. They flaunt their sin. They're not ashamed of it. And you see that with these gay pride marches. And homosexuality is a sin. It's a terrible sin. And they speak of it and act as if it was something to be proud of. They even call it gay pride, don't they? And the thing is, that's an important identifying feature. So I concluded that he was not genuine in the end. So let's look at some lessons and conclusions to be drawn from the story of Carlos. Number one, the fact that a man exhibits great power, even if it is from God, and I don't think his power was from God, I think it was demonic. But even if it's from God, as in Samson's case, does not mean that that man has a good character and is trustworthy, or even what he teaches is true. Samson's character was seriously deficient in various ways. He was carnal, he was foolish, he was unwise, and yet he had tremendous power. And so, remember, measuring character by giftedness is measuring temperature in decibels. You're just being silly by doing that. You can't do that. So we should not be surprised by such things. They shouldn't be seen by us as being some kind of aberration, that we're just marvelling at how strange it is. It's quite normal for people to be false, even if they have power, whether it be demonic, which is normally the case, or even if it's genuine power that they have. It doesn't make them doesn't mean that their character is valid. And so even Apostle Paul warned us in relation to the Antichrist. He will come along and convince many. So the thing is, it's not just at the great level of the Antichrist who will convince people, but even small little diddly squat people that know you and that you know them, they can be convincing too. They can have power. It's all the same whether they're great or low. And we must never be taken in by displays of power. Just a display of power in and of itself does not prove that a man is genuine or that his teaching is biblical. And look in 2 Thessalonians 2, verses 9 to 12. Paul is speaking here. He says, "The coming of the lawless one by the activity of Satan will be with all power and with pretended signs and wonders and with all wicked deception for those who are to perish, because they refused to love the truth and so be saved. Therefore God sends upon them a strong delusion to make them believe what is false, so that all may be condemned who did not believe the truth but had pleasure in unrighteousness." It's worth dwelling on that passage. The thing is, if you don't love the truth, if the truth doesn't matter to you, there will come a point, not immediately, there will come a point where God will hand you over and allow you to even send upon you a strong delusion. God won't start it, but he will finish it. If you start it by demonstrating by your conduct and attitude that you have no regard for the truth and you keep doing so, there will come a point where God will say, "I recognize that you have no regard for the truth at all. I now hand you over into delusion." And the frightening thing about that is, I think the person then becomes incapable of identifying what's true anymore. They become so blinded, they can't even tell anymore. So what you've got to do, at the point before you have become blinded, have a high regard for the truth. Love the truth for its own sake. Even if the truth disadvantages your position. Even if the truth shows that this court case needs to go against you, not for you. Do you see? The truth matters for its own sake. And if you don't care about the truth, you will make yourself a candidate to be deceived, because God himself will hand you over and allow you to be more deceived than you already were. Because if you don't care about the truth, that should be your main protection. The love of the truth protects you from deception. If you don't have it, you're handed over into it. So, the presence of such power or gifts, even if real, but especially if false, does not mean that a man is of good character. So power by itself proves nothing and validates nothing. What matters is a man's handling of the Bible and his character, the way he handles life day by day. That's what matters. Not power, and even if it's extraordinary miracles. All right, now another point. Watch out for and avoid any men who hype up their own ministries or speak in self-aggrandizing terms. And it's a warning sign to watch out for, especially in church leaders. Do they hype up their ministries? Do they praise themselves? Do they speak in self-aggrandizing terms? And that's common. It's not only amongst well-known false teachers like Creflo Dollar and Benny Hinn. Those men are false. But those are famous false men. But there are lots and lots of false men who are not famous at your local level. And if a leader is puffing himself up, exaggerating his impact, exaggerating his importance, seeking for prominence, See, we're not meant to seek for prominence. We're meant to seek for faithfulness. We're meant to seek for obedience. We're meant to seek to humble ourselves. We're meant to seek to crucify the flesh. We're meant to seek to enter by the narrow gate. We're meant to seek to do a whole bunch of things that we're meant to seek for. But prominence isn't one of them, you see. But many men are seeking for prominence because they want to indulge their pride and their ambition. Well, there's nothing wrong with wanting to be successful and so on, but we mustn't seek prominence as a means of achieving the indulging of the flesh, whereby we just want to be famous, we want to be liked, we want to be well known, we want to be everyone to be admiring us. We mustn't do that. That's what our flesh nature wants. Everybody's flesh nature is rotten, and it wants things like that. And what we've got to do is say, I know I've got a rotten flesh nature. That's why we're meant to crucify it. Crucifying it means not letting it have its own way. It means saying, no, I know what you're like. You're a rotten little flesh nature. Well, you're not having it. You're not having your way today. You see? Try not to do it out loud, else you might be taken away. Try and do it quietly. But you're meant to resist your flesh nature and say, no, you're not having your way. You're not having what you want. I'm going to humble myself today. I'm going to do what's right. I'm aiming for obedience today, faithfulness, truthfulness. That's what I want today. These are the things we're to do. Now, where we see a leader in particular, I mean, it's wrong for anybody to hype themselves up, but where we see a leader in particular doing that, it's particularly dangerous. And I've seen many do it. In fact, if you look quite often at leaflets and posters and flyers and websites and adverts for people's conferences and ministries and things, look at the words they use. You know, you'll see stuff that they write about how it's going to be amazing, international, powerful, anointed. And they describe themselves in these terms. You know, not just now and then. I would say it's pretty much routine to hype yourself up. It's fairly routine. So they talk as if they were advertising stuff on the telly. You know, washing powder or hairspray or something. And they big themselves up. We mustn't do that. When we speak of ourselves or our ministries or our events, we must speak in modest, factual terms. Just make factual statements. And erring on the side of understatement. Don't big yourself up. So, to give an example of this, I was concerned one day. I saw a passage, you know, the church leader I spoke of called, I'm calling him Rick. Rick had written a new draft website for the church we were in back then. And in this, he made various grandiose claims about the church and about himself. And it finished with one particular phrase, and I saw the draft. And I was really aghast at when I saw it. And it spoke of himself, and it said, some would say that his ministry is apostolic, you see. Now, when I saw that phrase, I just winced. And I couldn't imagine how anyone could write that about themselves. And so, quite apart from all the rest of the hyperbole and exaggerated trader's puff that was there, that phrase really hit me. So I challenged Rick about it. And I said, but Rick, I said to him, you wrote that yourself. And I said, it'd be bad enough for an overzealous friend to write it about you and then allow it to be put on the website. But you wrote it yourself. How could you do it? So I challenged him about it. And I should mention, by the way, you might think I'm a terribly horrible person to go challenging people. But I don't think that Rick ever had a more genuine, faithful, sincere friend than me. There you are, now I'm hyping myself up. But the thing is, I don't think he did. I just told him the straightforward truth. I went to him one-to-one and quietly and gently said to him, Rick, you can't say this. Anyway, he didn't listen to me. He didn't listen to that. But I also challenged him about other things he was doing. Our church at that time was doing some things to help a church in Africa. And Rick used to hype that up, make it sound bigger than it was. And he would talk about it as international work. Well, that's technically correct, but it's an unnecessary sort of grandiloquence, isn't it? You don't need to say that. Why don't you just say, I said to him, Rick, why don't you just say, our church, on the website, our church is trying to help another church in, and then give the name of the town, and say nothing to make it seem more impressive than it is. Just say, our church, St. Dudas, is trying to help St. Thingamis, and we're just helping them. Just say that. Don't big it up. Don't say anything to say how magnificent it is, or about it being international. Because many, many church leaders have got this idea that they want to be successful and important, and they want to be international, and they want to be anointed, and they want to be famous, and so on. It's a real thing you must avoid. You must not seek for the approval of men. If you're not seeking for the approval of men, you make yourself much harder for the demons to trip you up. If you're seeking for the approval of men, you become easy to trip up. So don't seek for it. Just seek for God's approval at the day of judgment. What I want is Jesus to say to me at the day of, at the judgment seat, I want him to say, well done, good and faithful servant. Do you see? Though that's the only thing that matters. That's the one that lasts forever. Now what's the point of throwing that away so that some Tom, Dick and Harry down here will speak well of you? You're throwing away that validation, that getting the Victoria Cross on that day, in order to get some badge out of a Kellogg's cornflake packet down here that you're having instead. You see? And you can have the real thing up there. Why are you throwing it away for a little badge down here? Amen. So, this is the thing. And I felt the way that Rick habitually spoke was proud and boastful and centered upon himself and on our church. In centering on our church, it was really centered on himself, because he wanted to show that our church was absolutely magnificent. Well, it wasn't magnificent. It was... But even if it was, why do we want people to think that it was? Even if it was, why not just let it be magnificent and let it speak for itself by its own qualities? Why say it's magnificent? Do you see? Now, I should have paid more attention to the hype at the time. I should have realised its significance and taken it more seriously. I did challenge Rick, but I didn't take it seriously enough. I went to him one-to-one and challenged him, but I should have done more than that. I should have seen it to have the significance it really had, and really I should have left the church much, much, much earlier. But it's not only in Rick's case that this happened, and it's not only in that context of bragging about, you know, your marvellous international work. People brag in all sorts of ways, not just about that. And I can think of another church I was in, led by a person, I've given him the name Carl. Now this wasn't a charismatic church at all, it was an evangelical, reformed, non-charismatic church. And I specify that because I want people to not think I'm picking on charismatic churches. Pride is not unique to charismatic people or reformed people or any kind of denomination. Pride doesn't come from what denomination you're in. It comes from your carnal flesh nature. That's where it comes from. But anyway, the point is this. In Carl's church, the leaders still had the same pride. It wasn't as flamboyant as Rick's. It wasn't as showy and right up front in your face pride, but it was there. And the thing is, I remember hearing them speaking about their own preaching and teaching. And they were praising it. They were praising their own teaching. And they used to use phrases like about the excellent teaching that their church has. And they say, people come to this church because of the preaching. Now this is being said by the men who do the preaching. I think, well, you can't do that. You can't speak like that about yourself. But what I also noticed was that the people in the church did it. They spoke very similarly, almost using the exact same phrases. And I used to hear people repeating it back, parrot fashion, about how excellent the teaching was, superb the preaching, superb Bible teaching. Now the reality of the matter was that, ironically, the teaching was mediocre at best and could only be described as good in comparison to the appallingly bad teaching that is happening in most churches. So it's like being able to do your times tables and saying that you're a terrific mathematician because someone else that you know can't do their times tables. Do you see what I mean? It was only in relative terms that Carl and his colleagues could say that they were great Bible teachers. I thought they were pretty thin, pretty ropey. It was thin gruel that they served up. It was just a very watery gruel. But at least it was that. That's the point. But the thing I'm getting at is, although they weren't as blatant and in your face as Rick was, because Rick was really braggadocious, these fellows were more subtle about it, but it was still there. Firstly, why were they saying things about their own preaching being so good? And secondly, why were the people doing it? These people in the church, I heard it from several, same phrases coming back. They were repeating back, parrot fashion, the phrases they had heard from the leaders. These were not their own conclusions formed from detailed scrutiny of the teaching, which they'd spontaneously put into words for themselves. They were just repeating back what had been subliminally said to them again and again by the leaders. And I noticed that. And it wasn't good. Like, we shouldn't do that. So let's make another point. Look out for and act upon the tiny momentary signals that wicked people give out. Now, such fragments of evidence reveal their nature and intentions, but they're usually overlooked because they're fragmentary, they're brief, they're small, and people tend to overlook them. Now, the problem is this. When you're dealing with the wicked, this is your basic starting point. Your problem is that you're not aware that they're wicked. If you already knew that they were wicked, identifying them as wicked would be a good bit easier, wouldn't it? But the point is, you don't know they're wicked. So here's our dilemma. We're trying to identify wickedness in people that we don't know to be wicked. Not yet. Obviously. If you did know they were wicked, you would act differently. You would speak differently, think differently, be on your guard more. But the point is this. The wicked are very numerous. I can't tell you how many wicked people there are, but I can tell you that they're very numerous. I can't tell you how many greenfinches there are, but I know there's a lot of them. Do you see? And if you said to me, well, until you can tell me how many greenfinches there are, don't come telling me there's a lot of greenfinches. Well, how do you expect me to count them for you? I'm just telling you, there's a lot of them. I don't know how many, but I wouldn't go out and fall over with astonishment if I saw a greenfinch. Or a blackbird. I wouldn't just fall over with amazement. I would expect to see a blackbird most days. I'd expect to see greenfinches, goldfinches. I'd expect to see all sorts of things most days. Do you see? Now, the thing is, if you don't know that people are wicked, then, of course, you've got to identify them from a starting point where you don't know who they are. You don't know where they are. But the thing is this, on any given day, you will probably be lied to multiple times by different people. And somebody must be doing it. Somebody is telling these lies. And I don't think I'm the only person in England who's being lied to. I don't think the devil has said, see that fella there? Let's just focus all our effort on him alone. Let's leave the population of the UK well alone and just pick on him uniquely to give him the false impression that there's a lot of wicked people in the world. No, I don't think so. I think what's happened to me is pretty normal, pretty ordinary, possibly a bit worse because I ran a business with a lot of staff. But apart from that, everything else, I've been seeing everything the same as everyone else. Okay, but the point is you need to keep an open mind because you are being lied to. You just don't know when, where, and by whom. And you need to therefore accept the possibility that even some of the people you know may be lying to you. The people you deal with in your job or at church or the people you know are lying to you, misleading you. And just admitting that the possibility of that and contemplating it is an essential starting point. Because if you don't recognize that as a possibility, how will you be able to identify things that you don't think are going to happen and you don't expect to happen and you don't or believe they'll happen? It makes you blind and deaf to the little signals that liars give out, that deceivers give out through their eyes, tone of voice, body language, words and so forth. And those indicators ought to warn you, and every clue needs to be checked out and noticed. And you need, therefore, to be astute and alert to these things. And I'll give you an example of where I failed to pay attention to a clue, all right? And I should have seen it, and I should have understood it, but I didn't. At the time, I only understood it later, and it concerns my PA called Julie that I mentioned in last talk. And she had previously been the secretary to someone called Chloe, who was a salaried partner. And Julie was extremely efficient, and when Chloe got into trouble, I discovered that Chloe, the salaried partner, was bullying and manipulating Julie, junior staff, and also telling lies, including telling lies about me. So I began an investigation into Chloe, all right? And at this point, I had already taken Julie from Chloe to be my PA. So some weeks or months earlier, I had already promoted, if you can call it that, Julie from Chloe to work for me directly. And therefore, when I began this investigation into Chloe, one of the things I needed was to set up an interview room, and I wanted to record the interview. And one of the things I used to do was record every interview. It's a very good technique, and I strongly recommend it. So I asked Julie, who was by then my PA, not Chloe's, to set up an interview room with a tape recorder. And what puzzled me, this is the clue I should have seen. When I asked Julie to do this, she was very nervous about it, very nervous about the meeting. She was very jittery about it all. But so far as I could see, she had no reason to be jittery or nervous. I wasn't accusing her of anything. At that time, I had no idea that she'd done anything wrong. Nevertheless, she was jittery and obviously very worried about the forthcoming interview with her former boss. Even though I would be conducting it, she'd just be sitting there taking notes. And at the time, I failed totally to see the significance or meaning of what she was doing. And I put her uneasiness down. I just assumed perhaps she's just uneasy about sitting in a meeting with her former boss and she feels sorry for her former boss. And I just assumed that. That wasn't a case at all. I don't think Julie would feel sorry for you if you were starving in a gutter. I don't think she would have felt worried. It wasn't about Chloe that she was worried about. She was worried about herself. So I dismissed the warning signs and assumed they were not significant. I thought she's probably just worried about her boss getting into trouble. Anyway, during this interview, there I was interviewing Chloe, and I think the Holy Spirit must have prompted me, but I looked down at the tape recorder and I saw, it was an old-fashioned tape recorder with a cassette tape, and I saw that the little thing wasn't spinning. You know, the little centre of the tape wasn't spinning. And I focused on it, and I realised the interview wasn't being recorded at all. And then I looked more closely, and I saw that although the tape recorder was plugged in at the wall socket, the electricity had been turned off at the wall, on the switch on the wall. So it was plugged in, looked like it was on. It had been pressed on, the tape recorder, but it wasn't on. And Julie was nervous, but she pretended she'd made a mistake and hadn't noticed it. And the thing is, she was very, although she was wicked, she was very efficient and very capable. That's why I'd promoted her. And at the time I thought it was odd that someone so thorough could make such an error. But even though I thought that, I didn't allow that clue. I didn't pursue it. I just dismissed the clue and didn't allow it to feature in my thinking, as it should have done. And I later discovered, completely separately, on much later, that Julie herself was false and devious. And then it dawned on me, as I replayed that whole day, why she'd been nervous about the interview and why she had switched off the tape recorder before it began. I understood it. She had sabotaged the tape recorder to make sure that I had no recording of that interview. And the reason was, she knew that Chloe had a lot of dirt on her, a lot of information that she could have revealed. And if it had come out, incriminating things could have been said. And Julie didn't want those things being said. She couldn't stop them being said, but she could at least stop them being recorded. Now that's more important than it might appear. Because, you see, I like to record things so I can go back and listen to it again. And sometimes it's only on listening to it a second or third time that you see the significance of something or the contradiction in something. And sometimes it's only if you see, like, the listen to tape one, tape two, tape three of different interviews, that you see the inconsistencies, the lies that people are telling. So you need to be able to listen again later. But also, I think Julie knew that if something had been said about her by Chloe, who I think was holding a kind of leverage over her, if something had been said, but I could only hear it the once in the interview, I might have just brushed it aside. But if I could have gone back later and listened to it again, I might have seen its significance. Julie knew that. She knew how I operated, and she didn't want me to be able to hear it again. So therefore she sabotaged it. Now this is the problem. My naivety and closed mind prevented me, firstly, from seeing the significance of Julie's nervousness. I just brushed it aside. I didn't realize it had a sinister meaning. It did, but I didn't see it. And later, I didn't see the significance of the switching off of the tape recorder. I just assumed that Julie's statement that she just made a mistake must be true, and I didn't dig deeper. And I should have done. Now, these are the little clues that you should pay more attention to. But also, just to elaborate on this point about being able to check things, it has wider application. Being able to replay conversations and events has a wide application. If you can revisit things afterwards, check exactly what was said, exactly the words, when, who said it, when did they say it, you can identify deceivers much more easily. And I would recommend that when you're having meetings, take notes. If there's a problem in a church or something, take notes of the things people say. And also, a good idea, keep a detailed journal of the things that happen in your life, things you meet, people you meet, things that are said and done. You can go back later when doubts are just beginning to form and check exactly what was said and done back then, 6 months ago, a year ago. And if you don't have any records, one of the things you'll do is begin to doubt yourself. You'll think, I must be just wrong. And when I was figuring things out in Rick's church, for a long time I kept telling myself, I must be wrong. I'm seeing a problem, but I must be wrong, because Rick is a real good man and I must be wrong. It must be me. But if I'd got more and more records to go back and check, I could have been better able to see the problem earlier. Because those records, if they're formed at a time when you had no reason to suspect anybody, and they had no reason to think you were suspecting them, those records will contain more accurate, reliable information that you can use as a guideline, as a point of reference, to gauge the truthfulness of what's now being said to you. But if you have no records, you're really living always in the present with no past, nothing to go back and check. And I would recommend that you do that, therefore. Well, I still haven't reached the end of this talk, so what I'm going to do, nevertheless, is finish just now, and we'll carry on after lunch.